I had the same experience as you when it's like, oh, I want to be good. You know, I'm going to, and I efforted at everything, almost like white knuckled, not sinning. And I think when we talk about that freedom from earlier, it's that God is sowing in us the ability not to white knuckle our faith. And, you know, if there's somebody listening out there that's like, whoa, I'm white knuckling right now, I just want to say that there is a way to live with God where you don't feel like you're just efforting the whole thing.
This is the Speak the Unspoken podcast, where we help parishes and dioceses unlock their ministry potential. Our goal is to host the conversation for you and ministry leaders on how to reach people in a post-Christendom era. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, Tim. I'm so excited that we get to talk again today. We chatted probably a few weeks ago offline, and I'm excited for us to replay some of that conversation on the podcast, but also just to get into some new stuff and just riff in a conversation with you. But thanks for saying yes and being on the podcast.
No, it's good. I'm looking forward to our conversation. I mean, we have, we've talked about it a little bit. You know, we have so many mutual friends, and I think you've been, I think you had said this too, it's true of me. You've been like one of my suggested friends on Facebook for forever, because we're just so interconnected in ministry and, you know, kind of the Catholic world and stuff. So it's, yeah, it's been great getting a chance to kind of catch up a little bit and talk about, really impressed, deeply impressed with the work you guys are doing at Glass Canvas, and excited to dive into it more today.
Yeah, if Facebook knows that we should be friends, then we probably should be friends, right?
I trust their algorithm to kind of,
when we were talking the other day, we started talking about this new ministry model, and what we've been doing in this season of the podcast is kind of discerning it with other people, and like, so having a conversation about what we see is happening in the world, and a lot of that's coming from that idea from that book, From Christendom to Apostolic Mission, that came out of the U Mary, and just this key idea that this is more than just an age of change, but it's actually a change of age. And our culture is going through a significant shift. You know, we've seen that in technology, but I think we're also seeing that like socially, like in very big ways. And that some of that's from technology, but some of that's from hundreds of years ago as the Enlightenment kind of progresses on and things like that. But what we're really interested in talking about is this new ministry model that is emerging in the church, where we're saying, hey, because of this change, we see that some things aren't working anymore. And it's not that they're bad, but it's that they're not effective in what we're kind of living through ourselves. And so it's a new ministry model in that it's not new in any sort of doctrinal way, or that it's some sort of new revelation, but it's new in that it's our age is new, and it's a ministry model in the right ordering of relationships according to the kingdom of God. And it's a model in that it's a modality of how we live our lives and structure what we do. And you being a strategist in your day job, I think it's a fun conversation to start. So I'm gonna pose something that I've noticed, and we can kind of go from there. Is I think we're moving from being in a guilt-based culture to being in a shame-based culture. And what I mean by a guilt-based culture is that we used to have a really strong sense of defined authority, right? And because we have defined authority, and that there is trust in sort of institutional authority, and, you know, just, and I'm not talking just in the church, I think as culture as a whole, we trusted sort of the fathering of culture that was happening on us. But now, that's kind of all gone away for a whole bunch of reasons. Some of it is like scandal. Some of it is as technology evolves, the shifting of power from older people to younger people. As we've kind of gone through this generation, we've been the ones who are leading the charge in knowing more about how to relate to the world that is emerging, like in technology, than our parents did. And I think that there's probably dozens of reasons beyond those two. But the interesting shift is that we're no longer trying to keep sort of this societal father figure happy by keeping the rules that have wisdom and knowledge, you know, knowledge and wisdom and in them, and feel guilty when we're not meeting them, but instead we're trying to keep our peers happy. And there's a huge difference between trying to keep a father figure happy and keeping a peer happy. One is like, I'll feel guilty if I break the rules. The other one is, I don't actually care about the rules and I'm just going to live my life anyways. And what that leads to is sin still has an effect on our lives, you know, because sin doesn't bring life. And so when we feel like life is not thriving, you say, like, what is wrong? You know, we don't say, when I can't say, this is what I did and it was wrong, I need to fix that. Instead, we just start feeling something is wrong with me. That's the difference between moving from guilt to shame. So I think that's a fascinating like sort of observation. And I've been reflecting on how does the kerygma have to shift in that scenario?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's like 8 great insights in there. I mean, I think it's probably no accident that Brené Brown's TED Talk on shame, which was, you know, came out like a decade ago or more, is like the number 2 or number 3 most viewed TED Talk of all time, right? Like, I think probably in some ways, if you want to understand our culture, you have to understand the dynamics of shame. Like, that's this kind of, you know, it's always been a universally, you know, kind of a ubiquitous experience. But I think your observation about, because of like what's driving some of this like prevalence of shame, is that peer-to-peer evaluation thing. Like, that's how I understand myself. And you're right. Like, sin has an objective impact on us. It's not it's not like sin stops mattering. Like, it stops impacting my nature just because I feel differently about it. Right. And you and I probably both know it, right? Like, we're both, you know, kind of on the younger side of culture still in so many ways. And like a lot of our peers, what I think people think sometimes still is, we live in this post-Christian moment. Like, you're talking about this change of age from Christendom to an apostolic context. And COVID's been an accelerant for all of these things, right? Where it's like, if we were, in many ways, I love that you guys are doing this kind of like discernment through prayer and conversation of like this ministry model, because that's how we're going to do it. Like, when I look out at the landscape now, even from 3 years ago, it's like, I don't even know where everything's going to have landed. You know, like, you see these huge disruptions, even in the way people invest, you know, with cryptocurrencies and, you know, like, these are huge societal institutional things that have existed for forever, right? The NASDAQ. And that's different now. Like, people do, you know, so these, I mean, we're still even sorting through the rubble a little bit of like what COVID has really accelerated. But like, a lot of people I know, we live in Denver. It's a pretty, you know, post-Christian, probably not as post-Christian as Vancouver, but, you know, maybe the next tier back or something, and pretty post-Christian city. And like, a lot of the young people here who, like, they're not rejecting Christianity the way they live. Like, they're just living how they're like, it's not a lot of thing. Our parents' generation, sometimes it was like, well, I grew up in this kind of guilt-based, you know, my Catholic guilt complex, and now I'm kind of, I resent that. So I'm rejecting that. And you talk to them and they're, well, I grew up and we had the sisters and they were, you know, hard on me. And so I want to reject, you know, the way that they, that's not what people are doing right now. But it's instead been this, you know, yeah, the father figure of God, we kicked him out a long time ago, right? And but what's also been contributing to that breakdown of is any semblance of guilt, like, maybe even in some, like, certainly I think there's a healthy aspect of guilt with God, but even like other institutions, like, what I think COVID has accelerated is there were a lot of these other kind of stable institutions still where you had to act, think, be a certain way in order to like fit into that. So there was a lot of, you know, people kind of were evaluating themselves based on, and what has happened is in all of those institutions, whether it's, yeah, Wall Street or Hollywood or, you know, whatever, it's like, one, the emperor has no clothes, because we've found out a lot of these guys were bad guys, right? Like, that's, you know, something that's actually happened, right? The McCarrick and then the Me Too and like all that stuff. But even more than that, like you said, the power has shifted where it's like, oh, I don't need them to approve of me in order to seek the things I'm seeking, which might be, you know, broken kind of notions of happiness and money or fame or power or whatever. But like, I don't need them anymore. I can do it on my own because I have a nice camera and a personality or something, right? So it's completely But what you're noticing, which I think is really interesting, is I think a lot of people are recognizing, yeah, we're casting off all of these institutions and how they've kind of like, you know, structured and ordered our society. But what replaces it, the shame connection, I think is very kind of fascinating, that the shame meter would kind of just keep climbing as those, which, and not saying those should remain, but we have to recognize too, what's left, because the human heart, it will always be made for God, you know? Yeah, so sin has that objective content no matter what.
Yeah. And you were talking about like, okay, these young people are like, they've rejected the church. And so in the absence of having like this place that says, hey, here's the way of life that leads to happiness, right? Like, and if you follow these rules, that's what's ultimately going to make you more happy. We've just rejected that. So what's left in its place? And I see the gap that we're finding right now is that everyone is being asked by culture, not the church, but by culture to say, hey, okay, define your own meaning. You know, like, you do you. And I'm not going to judge you, because we're all kind of figuring out how to define our own meaning. And you define your own meaning by what you think is going to make you happy, right? And you talked about power. It's like, what if my happiness is actually in opposition to yours, right? And I feel like it's things like that the Me Too movement is birthed out of. Like, the people at the top had power and they said, look, I want to use you for my happiness. And that broke. And in this way, like, when there's no divine order that we're kind of like saying, hey, like, I want to live according to, like, you know, a spiritual order, we're left with chaos in some degree. And it's like, now I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to look around to me. I'm not going to look up anymore. I'm just going to look around and go, hey, Tim, how do you think I should live? You know, and am I meeting up to your standard? Do you like how I'm presenting myself to the world?
And, right.
You know, it's exhausting.
Well, it is. I mean, that's why people are so, you know, anxiety, depression, all these things go up. And it's like, because in a lot of ways, like, guilt, you know, we don't want people to be doing things out of guilt, but it's a more positive emotion than shame, right? Would you've heard it, you know, probably like the Brene Brown thing. It's like, you know, guilt is I did something wrong. Shame is I am wrong, right? And when I'm the arbiter of like what meaning, truth, how to live, how to find happiness, I'm also on the hook for that. So if I do all these things, I do yoga every morning and I, you know, try to get out into the mountains, and I'm like, because that's what I actually see with here, which is really interesting, is sometimes that search for meaning and that making myself the arbiter, it can lead to like a very kind of mediocre existence where you kind of just eat a ton of fast food and like, but it can also lead to this like hyper, like searching after, like people here just live, like they're in the mountains all the time. And they're like, this is a rush hour here in Denver is like 4 PM. Cause people are like, I got to get home and get on my 20-mile run. And I'm going to get into the, you know, do my bike ride. Like, people are really looking for a way to live vitally that brings, but when we, you know, still experience those quiet moments, when all of a sudden we recognize, you know, that like, I'm still like super empty. And in fact, like doing all this and even living, trying to live really well is not actually like touching the deepest places in me. If we're the arbiter of that, well, I'm also responsible for it now too, right? So I am wrong. There must be something wrong with me, and everyone else kind of gets this. They seem fine, right? Cause we're all kind of wearing our masks, but like, I must be the one that just doesn't, you know, quite get it. So I think that shame kind of thing, and the lessons that it teaches it doesn't go away just cause we don't feel guilty anymore.
Yeah. And I actually think it changes how we communicate to our world. You know, like we talked about this charismatic shift. When I was sort of growing up, confession was talked about almost in terms of like, this is just an overall sense, you know, it's not that, you know, somebody came out and said this overtly, but it was talked about, oh, this is how you wipe away the guilt from,
sure, yeah,
from sin.
Yeah.
And I was like, right. You know, okay, so I sin, I go wipe away the guilt and I do that. And, you know, in an unhealthy way, you kind of go, oh, this is the, you know, I check the box of like, you know, sin on, you know, that's where this sin on Saturday night, confess on Sunday morning kind of expression comes from. And obviously that's not healthy. But I also think as that translates to what the core gospel message is, it I actually think that there's a lot of hope that it becomes more beautiful in a shame culture. And here's why. Because if I can go, if Jesus just came to forgive my sins, you know, and which is a reduced version of the completeness of the gospel. Hey, you know, I'm a sinner. He came to die for my sins. And if I accept him, then I get to go to heaven. Right.
Right.
And
right.
And obviously no one tries to reduce it down to that simplicity. But in a shame culture, we have to actually go deeper. And we have to say, you know what? We had a relationship with a heavenly Father who was perfectly good. And his heart was on trial. And we put his heart on trial. We said he wasn't good. And our first father and mother, like, you know, rejected the notion of being a family. So what was lost in that scenario was actually this connection with the divine. And Jesus then became man so that we could become divine again. Like we can become like God, you know, and he will live in us. And you actually become a son and daughter of the Father. And I feel like the potency of that message is just incredible in my mind, you know, as opposed to purely the sin. And there's parts of sin that come into that message as well, for sure. But really, now we get to talk about an identity change, not just a good standing status change.
Yeah, I mean, you make a lot of good points. That initial proclamation piece, we've been talking about ministry is critical forever, right? But I think your point's really keen, where we need a way of talking about sin that actually responds to a shame versus a guilt culture. And these are the things where it's like you talked about this change of eras. We're not like, even I would say like the principles are timeless. Like the proclamation of the gospel and focusing on initial, you know, charismatic, you know, messaging in order to like reach hearts. I mean, that's been around since Pentecost, right? Peter bursts out of the upper room and preaches the gospel, you know? Now, what I think is interesting about what you just said is you're right. Like as soon as people hear kind of more like what they could conceive of as kind of legalistic sin language, I do think they shut down. Like that's just seen as kind of repressive religion, ideology, whatever. I'm not interested to it. But when you look even at the church fathers and the way that they would talk about the gospel and what Jesus done, it was kind of more like a modern. And I mean that in the sense of like kind of the way the church uses the word modern, like the last 500 years, right? We kind of break down, you know, not like the last 20, but a more modern convention to really focus on. Even the manuals of kind of morality became very like, do this, do this, do this, you know, like the philosophy and ethics became kind of more wrapped up in this like more legalistic way of looking. So certainly, yeah, when Jesus comes in order to win our redemption, right, as our redeemer, he is doing so. He himself, right? He says, nobody takes my life from me, right? Like willingly, I lay it down, willingly, I pick it up. Well, what's he doing when he does that? He's trying to show us the Father is actually love. Yeah, the catechism says that we sin because we lost trust in the Father. I love what you said, his heart's on trial. So we need to know that if I'm ever tempted to think, it was while we were sinners that Christ still died for us. And so if I'm ever tempted to think I'm not good enough to receive his love, there's the cross, right? He's also remitting sin, right? There is a punishment. There's a gap that he's closing that sin has created between us and God. And so he's taking that punishment to himself. And those are the two that we often really focus on, right? This is kind of a point that's made by Father John Ricardo, who works here a lot with us in the Archdiocese of Denver through his ministry, Acts 29. But the third that like the church fathers focus on more than anything else is that in sin, we've actually become captive to sin and death. Like there's a situation of captivity that is breaking me down every day of my life. And I'm not even aware of it. We've been taken from our Father's house. And what he's doing in hanging on the cross is he's come to get his world back, right? Sent by the Father, who from all eternity wanted us to exist, lost in sin, captive, you know, by the devil, right? And this is how he fights for his children, right? Like this is how he wins us back. And the message of that is, you matter, even in your shame, even in your sin, more than you ever possibly could have imagined. Like this is what your God would do in order to like to take those things into himself so that you never have to experience slavery and captivity to them again. And what I think you pointed to, which I love, is the Catholic notion then of the response and the possibility of redemption that comes with it actually changes me, right? Like it actually does something to me in my nature where God became man so that man might become like God, right? Like it's not just, oh, my sin kind of gets wiped away, but it's actually like to my very core, I become something loved in my unloveliness. I then become something actually lovable, like worthy. And that is, I mean, shocking, right? Like what happened to Mother Teresa, what happened to John Paul II because of their surrender, because of their littleness, their openness to that redemptive work of God, they're just total like giving it all, abandoning themselves to him, actually changed them like in their core and in their nature. And that's like, man, if anything could ever speak into that shame narrative, to me, it's that.
Oh, and I think it I love that you're like talking about like Christ came to set us free, you know, like from captivity. Or, you know, we read John 10:10 and it's like, I've come so that you can have life and have it to the full. And I feel like, I think there's parts of church culture, depending on where you are, that, you know, they get this right, but there's lots of parts that get it wrong where it's like, we're not actually trying to live to the full. We're just trying to like live according to the statutes and the laws. And like, how do we like become good practicing Catholics, right?
Right.
Instead of how do we become free children of God, right? And as you and I experience this, like I had a conversion, I would say almost a conversion to Jesus first, and then it took maybe a decade later to have another conversion to the Father, which is kind of strange. But in the conversion to the Father, and I also think like our maybe this is prophetic, maybe it's not, but I think that in this new model, there's going to be a return to the emphasis of the fathering of God, right? Mm. Like when I was growing up, it was very, I would say Jesus-centric, you know, like, but I think that, and it's not, when you said earlier, like the truth is, it doesn't change. And like, it's not that the church hasn't been talking about these things. I just think throughout history, we've had different emphasis on, you know, is the plural of emphasis emphasize?
Emphases or
anyways.
Mooses, Mises. Yeah.
Emphasize. I know that's wrong, I think.
There's no way it's that, but it's, yeah. I don't know what it is. I'm not sure.
But if we're going to be wrong, let's obviously be wrong, you know?
Yeah, let's go 100 miles an hour wrong. Yeah.
And I think it's like, even Christ the King, like, I don't understand what it's like to live under a king. You know, like,
I can
kind of mentally assent to like, yeah, I love the idea of Jesus being my king and my Lord, you know? And I can understand in the terms of like how you framed it with John Paul II and Mother Teresa, like surrender, you know, like that's, you know, that I do have somebody who I can trust with my life and surrender. But there's times in history where different parts of God's character and nature and whatever have been emphasized in order for us to have more impact in our culture. And so I think the fatherhood of God, I do feel like this freedom is coming out too. And it's powerful. You know, you see the light come on in people's eyes when you're not talking about, you know, the sin stuff as the leading thing.
Yeah, we're a culture that's been so let down by our fathers that we want to reject the authority of the father, thinking that that's the source of the problem. But it's like, no, it's broken fathers, right? Like it's like we actually need that fatherhood. That's how you can live freedom. It's only under the umbrella of like his authority, right? That you can like live the freedom that comes from being a child. And I think, I mean, it's interesting too, right? Because if you look at Jesus's ministry, very father-centric, right? I've come to reveal the Father. The Father and I are one, right? Like, what is he doing? He's trying to reconcile us to the Father. Like, everything he's, you know, nothing I say on my own is like, so I ask people sometimes, it's like, who's the central character of Scripture? And people, you know, say God or Jesus, you know, it's like, you know, certainly, but it's like, no, this is the story of a father, right? The father creates. And then when his children are lost, he comes looking for them, right? Like this is it's almost like the show, This Is Us or something. You ever watch this show where it's like Jack, I mean, he's my favorite dad of all time. I just like, he's just the best. Right. And like, but he's kind of, you know, he's not in every scene. Like even, you know, he's gone now at some point, but it's like the whole show is about Jack and what has happened to what happened in him and his marriage, what happened with him and his family. Like, even if he's not, I think it's the same way in Scripture, even the Spirit, right? The Spirit intercedes in our heart, crying out, what? Abba, Father, right? Like this is, he is in so many ways, but for me, certainly the same way, where it's like, yeah, I had an encounter with Jesus in adoration, kind of like started living out the faith. And then I remember it was when I was studying abroad, I read Henry Nouwen's Return of the Prodigal Son. And it shook me. Like I've been trying to be faithful. I've been trying to get holy, right? I've been trying to be good, you know, and really even be a saint. I would have told you, like, I'm trying to live a life to the full. But there was something about the way that God was positioned in there where it's like, this is, if this is this image, right, this painting, it's all about the Rembrandt painting, you know, Return of the Prodigal Son, but also that story. And it's like, if this is something God is showing us about himself that Jesus has come to reveal, that's probably not the God I interact with. I don't experience probably that blessing on my life that would say, go be like, live a life to the full, like live an abundant life, have an open heart. I think my heart was, even though I was trying, you know, to follow God, it was very cramped and fearful and kind of limited. It's like, just don't step outside of this box. Like that's, and at some point in my, I think for a while that was good because it kind of helped me put away some like major sin in my life. But after that, it became like untenable. I just wasn't able to grow kind of keeping myself in that more limited framework of how I related to God.
Yeah. I feel like, man, as you share that, I have so many of the same experiences. Like one, I've asked people the same question of like, hey, who do you think the central person in Christianity is? And, you know, they always say Jesus. And I'm like, no, you know, it's the Father. Even the way liturgy is set up, like we're actually presenting Jesus to the Father, right? Like,
yeah.
And it once
to the Father, like, through the Son, in the Spirit. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And the altar is to God the Father, right? Like we're Jesus right there on the altar. You know, anyways, and the prodigal son, like Rembrandt's, I served on a men's ministry team where that was the whole theme. We just had like giant projection of that. And in that retreat, one of my friend's dads, I felt like I was like, oh, I'm doing pretty well. Like, you know, go do like participate in like the altar call kind of stuff or the receive prayer. And I, you know, oh, here's a word for me. And then as soon as I prayed this thing, one of the things that happened in that retreat was my friend's dad just ran at me and like fell on my knees and he hugged me. And I was like, I had no idea what was going on, but I just cried, you know? And like, I probably hadn't cried for 15 years before that point. And just being moved by the power of a good dad, you know? And like the father was definitely working through my friend's dad there who, it's really powerful, but I'm amazed at how many, of these same sort of stories and experiences that you and I have in learning God's heart, as a father to us and as a good dad. And if I'm honest, like all the things I still struggle with now, I want to go back to like, I had the same experience as you when it's like, oh, I want to be good. You know, I'm going to, and I efforted at everything, almost like white knuckled, not sinning. And I think when we talk about that freedom from earlier, it's that God is sowing in us the ability not to white knuckle our faith. And, you know, if there's somebody listening out there that's like, whoa, I'm white knuckling right now, I just want to say that there is a way to live with God where you don't feel like you're just efforting the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I
felt like I was always trying to like still earn his love. You know, it was always still just like, I'm doing it. Like I had a really good week. I hit my prayer time I did my rosary every day. Like I didn't do any like really obvious sins, which is funny because now I feel like the more confidence I've grown in God's fatherhood, the more I've actually started to recognize patterns of sin in my life. Cause it's not just like the five that I really cared about that are more kind of external, you know, right, kind of legalistic, frankly, you know, things. I remember we have a mutual friend who works in ministry and was a household brother of mine at Steubenville. And I remember meeting him. I'll say who it is. It's Pete Burek.
Okay. He's on the podcast before that perfect. Hasn't launched yet. So yeah, people know.
So when I met Pete, there was something about him that scandalized me. Like I almost didn't know what to do with him at first. And I realized it later. I lived with him a little bit when I moved to Ann Arbor. Like, and so I got to see him in his family life, and it was, recognizing, and I've told him this, I think I've actually even told him this on his podcast, but it was like, what scandalized me about Pete was his radical confidence that God was just like good with him. And it almost bothered me at first where I'm like, because I didn't live that way. Like, I didn't think God was good with me. I thought God was good with a version of me that I was spending every day of my life trying to be. But it was like, Pete knew God loved him. And it was like, seeing it, there's something about like hearing those notions, you know, you go to a retreat and like I'm like, okay, that's something that like makes sense conceptually that I guess would be like a good freeing experience. But then seeing Pete actually live it out, I was like shocked. I was like, oh, that's the kind of freedom and boldness and confidence that you can live with, that you can talk with, that you can, when you just like know you're loved. And my wife and I have actually, this is a guy I agree with, keep talking about, I love talking about my friends as part of it. So it's, you know, but like, we actually talked about like, how do we raise our kids with that same kind of confidence? Cause we asked Pete about it one time, he's like, this is just how my parents and the community that we grew up in, like, that's what they tried to put in us, is like radical confidence that you're loved. And I'm like, I want kids like that. I want them to just like, they just live the freedom of, you know, knowing that they're, what's the verse? Like the knowledge, the Holy Spirit, I'd have to find it, but it's in John's gospel, like the radical, like the freedom of the children of God. And I'm like, that's what I want for them, you know, because that wasn't my experience. I didn't grow up knowing that. I think I've noticed it start to sink in more. It's still a battle I fight. It's starting to work, you know, over time, but I'm like, that's powerful. That's a powerful way to live your whole life.
Yeah. I have a mentor who said, how would your life be different if you knew your place was secure? And I was like, well, you know, where do I begin, you know? And yeah, but living that way, living as if, you know, God is a good father is radically different. And I think it also calls something else into question, is like, how do we live as brothers and sisters in that reality of God being a father? And I feel like part of this new ministry model is we're going to see a return to discipleship groups, you know, or smaller groups, or like learning how to do life better in that. And like the way you talk about Pete and these other people, like it's the surrounding ourselves with other people who are like fighting to be in the walk on the narrow road that's tough. And I think that as we start to discern and say, oh, like how are we actually ordering our work and our ministry and helping other people do that in the church for the small, I think small group is like got this, you know, associations, but this discipleship group of people who are like, look, I'm in it. Like Pete was in it with you, you know?
Yeah.
So don't know what you think about that.
Yeah. I've actually had the same similar conversation with someone who runs a major ministry where it's like, is it life groups? Is it community groups? Is it like, we got to find a better word. Cause yeah, there's like connotation there of just like, we get together and like go through a resource and, but right. there's less of us.
We you all know? Hide behind a book, you know, and yeah. You know, like,
and talk about God. So I never have to actually be vulnerable. And the, I think, one of the things I noticed, I was in seminary for a year. I was at Mundelein Seminary outside of Chicago. It was Bishop Barron's first year as rector there. So he was Father Barron was my rector, which was awesome. And I remember he invited in Cardinal George, who's just a legendary kind of intellect and very much so of this. I would consider him, there's, you know, certain bishops that stand out in my mind is like, they got this post-Christian apostolic age thing and have been talking about it for a long time. It's almost like once I kind of like, you know, got red pilled to that idea or whatever. Like yeah. I looked Matrix. Back over the years yeah. And I was like, oh, these guys, like John Paul, like lived out of this. Like he knew this was happening. And, so the, Cardinal George, Bishop Barron will quote him actually in other talks as saying this, where he said in every age of the church, when there's been a needed renewal, it's always been the orders that have driven that renewal. And he would kind of say, you know, where are the orders today? And it was almost like an honest question of like, you know, certainly there's been CFRs or kind of these amazing renewals, the Dominican Sisters of St. Cecilia, like renewals of different types of religious life, but it's always been driven. And I've thought about that a lot. And I really think it is like, this is the age of the laity. Like we as lay have to live this kind of, so if you look back at these orders, like how did they always bring renewal? It was always living like a radical new form of holiness in community that eventually led to mission, right? It's communion and mission. That's like what the church is we're a communion with God leads to communion with others. Like that kind of sends us on mission. We bring others into that communion. And the thing that I think is compelling about that is like, we have to then live this kind of community. Like, there's no other option, right? Like, we actually say parish of people all the time, like, we want to be a parish of community. I'm like, great. You should be a parish that creates community for people by helping them find smaller communities of communities is what parishes should be, right? Where there's people actually living, doing life together, accountability, vulnerability, like really getting into it. But I think what that requires is what the monks always had was stable community, right? Like they had, we live in this very unstable kind of individualistic world, right? Like we structure our neighborhoods as like, basically just shut your garage. You don't have to talk to anyone. You can have a big yard and no one ever has to see you. And like, the whole ordering of our world right now is like trying to push us further and further from each other. And I think a commitment of life, a commitment of community is what's needed, because like the monks do that by vow, but we as lay people have to make that choice intentionally, where it's like, I'm committed to you, not just because like it works for these 8 weeks in my schedule, or because we can go through this resource together, whatever, but it's because like, I just want to like do life with you and help each other be better. And I'm not going to like hide from who I am or from who you are. I'm not going to need you. We're so like consumerist sometimes in our relationships, where it's like, we're just kind of looking for, like, it's like we want the Bumble app for like friendships, where it's like, who are the people that are just going to fit all the perfect, and like, they're never going to bother me. It's like, we need to find stability of community that's going to allow our kids to grow up in relationships that they know for a long time. That's going to allow us to like, you know, and I think that's hard to find. I think that's something a lot of people are craving, but that's not like easy to do. It usually takes someone having to be first and actually knowing how to build that with other people. And it just takes like a ton of effort and time, especially if we don't have instinct for like what that looks like. So I don't know what you've seen as far as that goes.
Yeah. But. Well, you're kind of talking about way of life. About 15 years ago, I had one of my good, you know, mentor, older father figures in my life. His wife was dying of cancer, and he's like, oh, Jason, I don't know where I'd be if I couldn't phone my friend Bob. You know, I wake up at 2 a.m. and have anxiety, and I need him to like go for a walk. And I was like, what? You know, like,
you have that?
You have that? And I was like, I don't have that. I don't have that. And I just needed it. So right after having that conversation, I was driving home and I phoned two friends. I was like, hey, this is what I need. Are you in or you're out? And if you're in, it's every Wednesday for the rest of your life, you know? And the one guy's like, well, every Wednesday. I was like, every Wednesday. And we've been meeting like every week. And like, it's a limited group of people. There's five of us total. And we don't do book studies. You know, we kind of figured out like that wasn't a way to grow intimacy with each other. And we just do highs and lows every week about like, hey, what's really going on. And sometimes one guy will just share, and that'll be the whole night, as just us like kind of pressing into where freedom is not breaking through, you know? And recently, like we've also, this idea has been stirring with us and people around us, and like sort of our larger group of disciples that we're walking with, is this idea of a way of life, you know, this commitment to a certain lifestyle. And as our world gets so busy and fast, I think what's going to become deeply attractive to people is us slowing down, you know, to reclaim like a holy Shabbat, you know, like kind of mentality. I mean, watching The Chosen, and like, I just love how they say holy Shabbat, you know, like it's small aside, but it's funny and it's, you know, self-deprecating. So I was like, man, this Shabbat feast must be amazing. You know, like they talk about it every episode. I think it's this like one big feast, you know, like maybe it's around. And like, my wife's like, no, Shabbat is just Sabbath. You know? And I was like, oh, I'm such a
idiot. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Anyways. So
like every 7 years they, yeah.
They're all preparing for it and whatever. I was like, this must be amazing. Yeah. It's just Sabbath. Anyways. So my ignorance comes out there for a second, but it's this way of life, like silence, solitude, slowing. Those are things the world is desperate for. And as we start living them, I feel like we become more and more attractive to them.
Yeah, it was interesting seeing like, you know, I mean, definitely this point has probably been over, you know, made in some ways, but the kind of the quarantine, you know, and how that, I know it's still going on some places, but like how many people, everyone went into it and everyone was like, you know, oh, we're all going to like, you know, and like all these people came out of it and they were all like, they had lost a ton of weight and they were like, you know, everyone's like
fat or fit.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's yeah. I was the latter. So I'm like, I thought we were all putting on a bunch of weight during quarantine, but the, no, but like there is kind of like a, and I sense, I talk a lot of guys I talk to, it's like, I can't ever go back to the way it was. Like we're, you know, it's gotta be, people are leaving jobs if they have to go back to offices full time. Like, I think we've all seen like, oh wow. Like we were living very unsustainably fast. And that there needs to be kind of a kind of like our jobs can't just be about consumption and achievement and like that there has to be more rhythms to it in family life, but also in friends. And yeah, I'm interested to see kind of if that shakes out, because it seems to be such a universal longing. But it's also the thing too, of like solitude is always like the monks didn't go into the desert to find themselves. They went to find God. And that's kind of one of the hard things, right? Is like, hopefully if more solitude and slowness creates, you know, like availability to kind of self-reflection, then like there would be more of a looking for something that could kind of satisfy some of those holes. But it can also be scary, right? Like it's also easier or comforting or tempting to stay fast, because like the unreflected life is comfortable sometimes, right? It's not worth living, but it's also like not always going to prick my conscience or my interior life the way other things could. That's cool that you have that. I think that kind of, yeah, that's something that like everyone needs. It's also something that we have to show other people that way of life. Like we have to teach it, right? Like there's a way of bringing people, they have to see it.
It's caught, not taught.
You know, it is. Yeah. It is. It's like you can't just be like, all right, go now do that. It's like you have to like, I know there's some churches that even like evangelical churches that have kind of broken down, you know, into a, you know, kind of small, basically like they exist as like house churches, and they kind of like people grow into these house churches and then they kind of split. And I'm like, there's an interesting kind of thing there, because it's like you can't just say to somebody, hey, go build like intentional community if they've never tasted it. But then there's always that tension of like, but that's also you and your five buddies, right? You can't just like go invite five randos into it. And like, you know, there's a gas mask that you're all needing to wear as well too. So there's always a tension there, I think. I don't know how we do that.
Yeah. And a lot of the, like I've been inspired by, we've done work with St. Paul's Outreach, which they're obviously centered around consecrated communities or
households, and yeah,
you know, households, like, but not even the campus side, like even just the staff, like Gordy and those guys, like they're still living in community, like
covenant communities. Yeah.
Sorry, I said covenant communities, where they're making these clusters of like houses within a neighborhood, and it's like it's so much easier to go, oh, that's what I want when I see it. As opposed to theoretically going, yeah, I want that. It'd be nice to have people who were close and things like that. But yeah, how do we see more, you know? And I'm sure that it extends beyond just community, right? I think it's, I want insight into people who are hearing God's voice more in prayer.
Yeah.
You know, like, can I just be a fly on the wall as you're doing that? And I think that's, like, that's what we were designed. Like, we're supposed to be in community with older brothers and, you know, older sisters who are saying, hey, this is the a little bit further on the narrow way that I've discovered. And this is kind of how I got there. And here's where I started to, like, you know, hear God's voice more clearly. And you, maybe not you, but I always want God to just jack up the volume.
Right.
But what I think he wants me to do is actually increase my hearing by being quieter.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh man, that's just God. Can't you just communicate the way I want you to communicate? And
yeah,
but God has a personality, you know, and he does know better than me.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Like for a long time, I would say sometimes along those lines of like hearing God. I mean the broader point there has to be some form of like lay lived experience, some way of life that is like different. That just doesn't kind of like, I think for a long time, we've tried to just kind of like baptize and adopt the conventions of the world and kind of like live them ourselves, but do so like more, you know, more virtuously. And I think I do sense a need for like our distinctive way of life as Christians has always been one of our great kind of testimonies to the truth of the gospel. And it's like, there has to be some different way of doing this that is, you know, that we like, I don't know, we just haven't quite unlocked yet or something. But the, along with that hearing, because I think that's my experience, right? Like so busy, I can't hear God. And I would even say to people for a long time, it's like, well, God doesn't really speak to me like directly, like personally, he kind of speaks through, you know, circumstances, like he'll kind of, and then it's been interesting over the last year or so, I've kind of been thinking like, and he does like, God will very clearly make his will manifest in my life, like through, you know, very direct, this thing happened. And I'm kind of just like, I can tell when I'm following, you know, like I can tell when I'm listening and when he's leading. But, there's been this interesting thing too, of like, maybe that's not like his preferred way of doing it all the time though. Like maybe he actually would like to talk to me like directly into my heart, and I'm just not being quiet enough or giving him space. I'm looking at my phone too much, like for him to actually, like, this is a concession he's making because I've, you know, he wants me to follow, he knows I'm willing to, but maybe he'd like to talk more if I actually gave him. So I actually have a question for you. I was, you know, thinking, you're talking about this kind of new ministry model, and I don't know if you've explained that on one of the earlier podcasts that I missed. So I've kind of been able to catch some of your clips and stuff, you and JM talking, which has been cool. But like what are you, what's kind of pressing on your heart with that? Like where is this kind of desire coming from? And maybe as you've talked to people, what's kind of emerged a little bit with all that?
Yeah, it's, it came out of prayer, you know, this, you know, I was just talking to, you know, this person that, you know, when the son's ready, the father appears, and this other guy, who's also, his name's also Tim, just said, "Hey, oh, that feels like the old model." And I was like, "Oh, there's a new model, you know, that's amazing." And it was around the time when we've always been in this discernment of, like, how do we reach our culture, you know, without compromising, without like doing all those things, but how do we actually love people to meet Jesus? You know, we're ultimately missionaries at heart. Even though we're in a company and we're building like software and stuff like that, like our hearts are like, the reason we do all those things is to unlock ministry potential, because we want people to come to know and love Jesus.
Missionaries who build software, not software engineers that are Catholic.
We don't need to do software. Like, I'll scrub toilets, you know, if that like allowed us to like
is do what the that
to
required.
Be more missionaries, you know, and, software just happens to be the thing. And but in the last 20, I've been a Christian for 20 years, and in the last 20 years we've lost 20% of people in the church. 20%. So since I became a Christian, 20% has dropped in 20
years. Do you think it's your fault, or like is that correlative or causal, or I'm just kidding.
So, you know,
maybe it's the rising tide of secularism. Yeah.
I mean, it's somewhat my fault, because I'm, you know, like,
yeah, the problem with the church is still me,
you know?
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Amen. I like that. Yeah. That's good.
But the heart of it, like, once, you know, this from Christendom to Apostolic Mission, and we got to spend time with Monsignor Shea, sort of a year before he launched that book. So understanding like this awakening of the Catholic imaginative vision, is just a powerful idea of like this idea of how to live culture well and things like that. But I think what's going on right now in this change of age is that we're rewiring how we do church, how we do ministry. And I think it could be a very profound rewiring, in the same way where we went from like candles to electricity being the light source in our home. We figured out how to, you know, what voltage we're going to wire through the homes, where we're going to put light switches, where we're going to put lights. And now when you build a home, you don't even think about it, right? Like, it's just like there's a standard. And I think the same thing is true of if we all discern together and we discern well, we can see what the Holy Spirit is up to help us reach more people in our culture. And so that's where this like new ministry model discernment comes through. It's like, I don't want to do this alone, you know, like, and I don't have all the answers. And you don't either, but if we talk about it, like maybe we can figure something out, we can share it, you know, and like, you can talk to Pete Burak, I can talk to him. Like, you know, and we can figure it out. And then there's lots of people who have a heart for saying, how do we remain relevant in our culture? And when we had the shutdown here in Vancouver, gyms were open, but churches weren't. And yeah. I honestly don't think that was a case of anyone going, look, I want to spite Christians. I actually just think it's the people who are making the decision said, oh, that's not really relevant to people.
I 100% agree. Yeah, I think people saw it as like a form of persecution. And I think instead it was a statement of how irrelevant we've allowed ourselves to become to the, like actually how people's lives kind of. Yeah, I think there's a good point there.
And so we've been like focusing on things like how to communicate or how to brand, all for the objective of becoming relevant without compromising the gospel. You know, it's not that we want beautiful looking brands because we're brand people. It's actually because we're missionaries and we want to figure out like, how do I make this thing? How do I explain this thing in a visual culture so that they can see that it's, oh, it's for me? Because like, there's a massive difference between saying, hey, the church doors are open, and then saying, no, this thing's made just for you.
Mm.
And I feel like when, you know, when we're building software, we're trying to figure out like, how do we make stuff that helps people to see that the gospel is relevant just for them?
Yeah, and, interesting.
And the new ministry model is that's the heart of it. That's what we're trying to get out into and discern with brothers like you and sisters. And so that's hopefully that answers your question.
No, very much so it does. Yeah, it's a beautiful kind of insight there where there's a lot of, I would love for it to be as second nature to parishes, you know, that like some of these principles that we talked about, yeah, God's fatherhood and, you know, and this kind of distinctive way of life and some of the things we've kind of been kicking around. Like, I would love for those to be second nature habits to like every parish in the world knows how to pass the basket. And that's not like necessarily, you know, there's the offertory as part of the liturgy, but it's like the way we do that is like, you know, there's certain conventions around the sacramental economy that we've adopted that are like, not necessarily always part of the rubrics, but are just like every parish knows how to do them, right? Every parish somehow in the country figured the bulletin was like a good way, you know, it's like, how do you develop these? And probably, I still think they often are like a good way to communicate, but especially to insiders, right? Like this is how they get information. But like, how do you, if there were these things that were, I like your image of wiring, like they were just wired into the nature of like how parishes, because the big thing you and that Christian imaginative vision or new ministry model, like what I hear a lot of people saying now is best practices are great. Like that's why but like really there's kind of these even like more fundamental mindsets around why we're doing what we're doing, which are more like, that's where it really starts, where it's like, we have to think differently about what we're doing. And then we can implement the right best practices in order to actually like effectuate those things, right? Like, 'cause I've seen people take the best practices, like things that I know work, that I've seen work, and like struggle to find fruit with them. And then they abandon them because it's like, well, that thing doesn't work. We're kind of just constantly, it's that silver bullet mentality, right? But there's this interchange instead between a vision, you know, that really, and then that like kind of a mindset around like what we're trying to do and how that actually, what actually works about ministry. These are timeless principles. And then we can combine the best practices kind of into it. Like that's the thing that actually creates, like when you look at these parishes that are really seeing a ton of fruit, usually that's what you find, is that they found a way to do all three of those in a really kind of life-giving, I was going to say effective, but it's more than just effective, a life-giving way.
Yeah. And there's an analogy that's been helpful to us. When software started getting developed, the project management methodology of the day was basically a waterfall approach. You design it, you build it, you ship it, you see, you know, what works in the marketplace, and then you like go back and you redesign it, and people in software were going, hey, this is not the best way for us to be rolling these things out. Like software actually can be project managed differently. And a few guys got together and they said, look, it needs to be more agile. And so they got together and they said, here are principles that they called the Agile Manifesto. It's this over this. It's this over this. And And I think that's what's happening in the church. Like, I would love for us to like get together at some point with a whole bunch of, you know, brothers, and like, hopefully this podcast is the beginning of this. This is, you know, the dream, and say, hey, what are the principles of the new model? You know, what have you discerned? What have we discerned? And it's not owned by any particular person, because if that catches and we discern well what the Holy Spirit is doing, then those parishes that you're talking about, they can go, oh, okay, like, I get it. Like, that's the better way to do parish or to do church or to be Catholic and things like that. Where right now, I still think that a lot of us are stabbing in the dark and it hasn't been fully revealed by the Spirit yet, you know? And I think that we're participating in that revelation.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the dream.
Yeah. Yeah, except for Pete Burak. He actually does have all the answers, right?
But, I need to have him again on the episode then.
Yeah, but, you might just have to talk to him. Yeah, but no, I think, yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like I've been playing a lot of golf. I'm kind of one of these. I've always played a lot of golf, but with it being the only thing you could do during COVID, I'm one of these people that started playing a lot more golf. And one of the things that's grown as I've played more golf is the ability to think through the course, right? Like, you can hit a good drive, but the right drive in the wrong way at the wrong part, like, won't necessarily help. Or like, you know, how do you make sure if from this position that you're going to end up with a par instead of a bogey? Like, if you take this, like, there's a lot more strategy and kind of like, there's an art to golf. Even once you've gotten your swing down where like, you know what the club is going to do to the ball, there's still a ton of, they call it course management, that kind of really needs to go into it. And it's very almost like kind of the agile process you're describing. There's these like principles that are, somebody even had a book, I think at one point, that was like, hey, if you like follow all these and can hit like semi-decent golf shots, you can pretty much like break 80 on any course, you know, because there's like enough variables and enough, but you need, even with, sometimes I think people do is because there are so many variables in ministry or in parish ministry, and because it's Spirit led, we can try to do the just best practices thing where we over-programatize it and just like roll out new programs and we're like thinking we're doing it. But we can also do this other thing where we're like, there's not really any way to catch where the Spirit will go. And it's like, well, no, like there's things that work and that don't work. There's things the Lord wants to do. There's a plan God has for parishes. And then there's not, like, there are this, not this type scenarios all over the place in terms of, yeah, managing a golf course or doing parish ministry. And I think there's an interesting kind of project. It's like, how can you help people think through the golf course a little bit more I think you're right. I certainly don't feel like, I feel like, yeah, there's some truths I've come to know about how those, like, about things that work. There's things I could confidently say, this, if you do this, like, you're going to see, if you allow God to lead and you actually like are serious about, like, he's going to, right? Like, he's going to show up. And then here's ways you can do that. Right. Like, yeah. There's principles I could articulate, but yeah, by no means. I think there's an interesting instinct there to how could a lot, like, what is God saying to a lot of people? And then how could you kind of bring that all together?
And I think too, like, there are principles that we can't know yet. Like, the internet wasn't around 50 years ago. I'm checking my dates, you know, like,
yeah,
30 years ago, maybe. Maybe it was basic form.
When did Al Gore invent it? Yeah.
And it's like that's going to change how we live together, right? And even the fact, you know, I've mentioned this before, you and I are chatting, forming a relationship on a computer. We're having a pretty deep conversation, probably deeper than I've had with many people who go to my parish. And the parish structure was done to organize how we actually incarnate reality, right? And I think that as our world shifts, as we come into this new age, we're going to have to figure out how to do that well, you know, and how to integrate technology into the way we form relationships naturally now. And I actually think it's an exciting time. I think, you know, there's a lot to you feel down about, but I actually think there's a lot to feel good about. Like, if we, you know, the addressing shame with identity, the, you know, the belonging that we're talking about in these groups, and being able to effectively, like, go to the digital continent and, like, evangelize there.
Conviction of the primacy and power of the gospel, you know, leading with a charismatic proclamation as, we could probably rattle off 10, right? You know,
and we're all trying to figure, well, I shouldn't say we all, but there's a growing amount of people who are trying to figure out how to do it well, some out of necessity, but I think the real heart of it is people are going, hey, we want more. We want more than the current reality. So,
yeah, I think the stats wake people up sometimes, but I don't think like, it's almost like, there was this weight loss app Noom that was like, it would kind of teach you, it would help you track your food, but it would also like teach you how to think about, you know, food and weight loss. It was kind of like, and I think there's almost something like that where it's like, people, read the stats and we're declining 20% in 20 years and, and it scares people, but what inspires people to action, there's like a deeper conviction about just like, this is the perennial mission of the church is to make disciples. And you have to fall in love with people. Like you have to say, the weight of my neighbor's glory is laid on my back. Like I have come to know the goodness of God and I want other people to experience that too. I never want anyone to go hungry again, that's what drives action. That's what drives substantial change where it's like, because change requires risk. Like change requires like leaping out into the deep. It requires surrender. It requires making people mad. It requires leadership. Like, and you're not going to do that just because like, hey, our church might close in 5 years, because like our numbers are going down and our giving's down. You might do some tweaks. You might implement a new, program or solution or whatever. But like, if you want like culture change, there's going to have to be a deeper why, a deeper motivation than just like, kind of like you're saying, than just, this is necessity is driving us to this.
Yeah. Man, I could keep doing this for hours, but our time has kind of come to an end. But
it's
been great having a conversation with you today, and I feel, blessed by it, and I hope others do too. And I just want to say thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it was great joining you. Many prayers for all of your work. And thank you for taking the time. I was a lot to think about. I'm going to be thinking about this conversation, I think, for the next few hours as I go about my day. So great talking to you, Jason.
Well, and we'll do it again sometime.
Sounds good. God bless you, brother.
Good. Peace. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts, or you can find out more at glasscanvas.io. We're so grateful that you could be with us today, and we're looking forward to catching you on the next episode.